From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Our future in space may be a little uncertain right now, but we do definitively live in the space age. Woven into our food supply, our system of civil order and safety and life and commerce is a network of critical weather satellites. They tell us what's coming. They're not gee whiz, they're critical infrastructure. You'd think Washington would make sure that satellite fleet was shipshape and solid. You'd be wrong. This hour on Point, America's wobbly weather satellites and the uncertain future of our weather forecasting. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you love watching your weatherman tell you what to wear and what the next few days will look like? Can you believe NASA and NOAA are scrambling to keep our weather forecasting system from going dark? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll look into space entrepreneur Elon Musk's plans for a new space port in Texas. But first, satellites and weather. 8 days before Superstorm Sandy tore up the eastern seaboard, Europe's Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts, with the help of satellites, correctly predicted Sandy was not going to veer out into the Atlantic, but would roar west and slam into the American coastline. Here was Fox News 3 days later on October 26, 2012, covering Sandy's path.
Meteorologists say this storm is soon going to collide with a blast of Arctic air, and that could turn it into a juggernaut, a superstorm. And government forecasters now say there is a 90% chance, a virtual certainty, that this superstorm will blast the East Coast.
Thank you, satellites, for the heads up. Same year already, growing alarm then in Washington about the decline of America's satellite fleet, leading to a spate of congressional hearings. Here was Congressman Brad Miller, Democrat, North Carolina, during a House subcommittee hearing on U.S. weather satellite programs.
Satellite-based weather and climate forecasts tell us whether to carry an umbrella on any given day, where to fly planes, what crops to plant, whether to run our power plants, how to plan military missions, when to take cover from deadly storms. When they work, when we get timely and accurate information, we are safer and more prosperous. But when satellite programs falter, we find that lives, property, infrastructure, and economic health are at risk.
We get it. We need them. And they've been in trouble. In 2013, the GAO put this country's weather satellites on its so-called high-risk list of critical federal programs in trouble. Joining us now from Bangor, Maine, is Catherine Miles, journalist, environmental science writer, and author of the forthcoming book, Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Her article, The Weather Gap, just ran in Popular Mechanics. You can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Catherine Miles, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's the gap we're looking at? What's the problem?
Well, there are two problems. We have two sets of satellites that are responsible for most of our weather forecasting. The first is the geostationary satellites, and these are satellites that fly at about 22,000 miles above the Earth. They hold a fixed point, so they don't necessarily rotate around the Earth. They rotate at the same rate as the Earth. And these satellites are primarily responsible for what we consider our short-term forecasting. When you see the weather person standing in front of a radar or standing in front of a satellite image, when you see the weather on an app, for instance, what you're looking at is these geostationary satellites. Mm-hmm. The second set of satellites are what are called the polar orbiting satellites. These are satellites that fly much lower to the Earth, and they fly around the Earth. They complete several circumferences a day, and they carry a series of sensors that detect everything from aerosols in the air to radiation, and we use this data to create our long-term forecast. So as you mentioned in the intro, things like seven-day hurricane forecasting, nor'easters, epic sort of proportion-type storms.
So what's the problem here? I'm reading that we may, before we know it, be relying on China's military satellites for some of this information. What's going on?
So both sets of satellites are actually in trouble, and both sets of satellites made the GAO list. They think that the larger problem, the problem we're going to have a harder time getting around is with the polar orbiting satellites. And we have three sets of satellites that we use for our data. We do a morning rotation, a midday, and an afternoon. Right now, the Department of Defense provides the data for that morning. The European Union provides the second, and then the U.S. NOAA satellite provides the third. And due to a series of sort of political snafus that were about 20 years in the making, we ran out of the surplus of satellites that we have. And so now we have a potential gap as we sort of scramble to create this new fleet of satellites.
How soon could what be missing from our satellite lineup and why?
So currently NOAA has two satellites in the air that are providing this polar orbiting information. We have one that's called NOAA 19, and it was the primary satellite, but it is now suffering from sensor degradation, and so it was switched over to backup. And then we have another satellite called the SUMI NPP, and this is a controversial satellite. It was originally designed as a test model. The new fleet of satellites were going to have some new sensor technology, and they designed this as a way to test it and make sure it was going to work. So it was designed with a lifespan of 3 to 5 years. And the idea was that we were going to quickly get another satellite up in the air that would be have a longer lifetime to it. But due to some political wrangling, what happened was the other satellite program was delayed. And so right now we have NPP at the end of its predicted lifespan. The next satellite isn't predicted to launch until 2017 and won't be fully operational until 2018. But the even bigger problem, they say, is that the satellite after that won't be ready until 2022, 2023. And these satellites are notorious for really high infant mortality rates, assuming they even get off the ground, period.
That is blowing up at launch. We've seen that with American satellite launches not so long ago.
And not only blowing up at launch, but failing catastrophically months after they were launched. There's multiple instances of this happening. So if that happens with this next satellite, what's called the JPSS-1 satellite, we could have a gap of several years, up to 5 years, where we won't have this very crucial data.
I mean, that's hard even to get one's head around. What would that nightmare scenario look like? If we've got a dying satellite and a temp satellite doing full heavy duty up there now. If we somehow don't fill this gap, what would the difference be for Americans in their day-to-day life and commerce and all the rest, agriculture, all the rest?
Well, we should say, too, that just, you know, to be clear, the temporary satellite is functioning just fine right now, and it is actually providing all the information we need. And that's one thing to make clear is even though it was a demonstration model, it is working and it's working just fine. And it also has redundant systems. So some people in the industry are optimistic that it will last. But regardless, if there is this gap, we have a series of possible solutions. There was a report that was authored by a private company called Riverside Technology, and they're a partner with NOAA and several of our U.S. Departments, including energy, commerce. And they authored a report last year, and they looked at possible mitigation techniques, and they came up with 40 possible ones. And what they saw as the silver bullet, that was their word, was buying this information from the Chinese military, which prevents some obvious national security issues.
So for what, a matter of years, possibly, we'd be dependent on the Chinese military in particular, to tell us what weather was coming to North America?
That's one option. Another option is also trying to rely more on the European Union. As I mentioned earlier, we already buy data and we already rely upon. We have a sort of a treaty agreement in effect with the European Union to buy data from them right now. So we could also expand that. They also have some satellite concerns. They're currently looking to China. They feel like China is the next best guess right now in terms of satellite longevity.
Isn't this kind of fundamental information to be reliant on anybody else for? I mean, is there some reason that the United States of America, biggest GDP in the world and all the rest, can't forecast its own weather?
Well, you know, this is a very long problem in the making. And from its inception, we've had no idea what to do with and where to place our weather system. It began as an off-branch of the U.S. Army. It was a part of the cavalry, if you can believe that. And
literally.
Then we tried— Literally. They were trained in sabers and horseback riding, and we thought that that was sort of an issue of U.S. military security.
Mm-hmm.
Then we placed the Weather Service in the Department of Agriculture for a while. Nixon placed it in the Department of Commerce in 1970 when he founded NOAA, and it's sort of been kind of a stepchild of these federal agencies. It's been sort of historically underfunded. We have these incredibly talented meteorologists who are capable of really great things, but they often lack either the infrastructure or the staffing or the funding that they need to get it off the ground.
But look around at all the severe weather we've had, all the impacts you can have on our food supply, on transit, transport, on, I mean, never mind military and all the rest. This is woven right into our lives, and now we're looking at climate change as well. Surely this is an era in which we need to be all over this.
It's impossible to sort of overstate the significance of having reliable weather information. Every aspect of our lives, every time you get on a plane, whenever you want to buy a product, whether we want national security, whether we want our Navy somewhere, all of these things rely heavily upon the weather, so much so that during the Cold War, you know, we, along with other leading nations, undertook a multi-million dollar study into ways in which we could use the weather as warfare.
Why isn't somebody snapping their fingers or cracking the whip? You know, where's the cool-headed, I don't know, government or whoever to say, this is unacceptable, let's fix this and fix it now? Couldn't we put together a concerted effort and fix this in 2 months?
Well, we certainly could. And I think if we had our lawmakers and our policymakers on board, we could do that. And certainly there have been several congressional hearings having to do with this. But, you know, we live in an era, obviously, of sequestration. We live in an era of budget shortfalls. And, you know, unfortunately, NOAA and the National Weather Service has been significantly hit by this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there of a launch earlier this year, February, of a joint U.S.-Japan project to put up a global precipitation measurement, GPM satellite, key component of America's efforts to beef up its troubled weather satellite fleet. One of our guests this hour was deputy mission scientist for that mission, courtesy there of CBS. Why do we need them up there? Well, we need them all the time. They're always telling us what's going on. Here, the latest big storms to hit the U.S. were Tropical Storm Izelle and Hurricane Julio hit the Hawaiian Islands last weekend. Here was local coverage of those storms from Hawaii News Now.
A lot going on the satellite image across the entire state. And so we'll watch this hour by hour for you, first with Julio, a hurricane. You can see it's getting closer and closer to us.
Satellites tracking that, and we all know just a few days ago, the Hawaiian Islands really wanted to know what was coming. They could, but we're looking this hour at the looming risk of the United States that cannot forecast its own weather as we grapple with big satellite problems in space. Catherine Miles is with us, author of Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy, coming out just a few weeks from now, and a big piece in Popular Mechanics called The Weather Gap, about what's going on with our satellites. Catherine Miles, stand by there in Bangor, Maine. With us right now from Athens, Georgia, is Marshall Shepard. He is director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia, was president of the American Meteorological Society in 2013, former research meteorologist in the Earth-Sun Division of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, and was deputy mission scientist for the GPM mission, which launched in February. We just heard it there. Marshall Shepard, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How serious do you see the potential problem in American weather forecasting if we don't get our satellite lineup strengthened?
Yeah, it really is an issue. I think my colleague has stated the case very well. I mean, not only do we rely on these satellites to let us know that storms are approaching like we saw in Hawaii, this data, particularly that polar orbiting data, is invaluable in our weather models. On our show on the Weather Channel, I host a show each Sunday at noon on the Weather Channel, mm-hmm. and we just talked about this very issue. We showed that the Superstorm Sandy forecast would have been completely wrong without satellite data being fed into these models. So I think many of our the listeners may not be aware of the fact that a large percentage of the information going into our day-to-day weather forecast models our satellite. It's no longer just weather balloons that we launch every 12 hours. It's critical to our understanding of the atmosphere. And I think that's very important given the extreme flooding, for example, that we just saw in parts of the Northeast.
Just in this last week, I have to say I do not understand how such a fundamental piece of what looks to me like national infrastructure could be allowed to get thin, vulnerable.
Well, yeah, I that's a great point. I have argued many times during my tenure as president of the American Meteorological Society that weather information is a national security. It's a national asset in the same way that many of the other assets in our federal structure are seen. As we heard earlier, every component of our lives, from the economy, American Meteorological Society has a journal that published an article that 3-4% of the gross domestic product that relies on weather information. Satellite information is critical. Now, I think over the last year or so, I think Congress and the various powers that be have gotten the message. We've kind of beaten the horse that there are issues of mismanagement, there are engineering issues. The sequester and the budget shenanigans in Washington didn't help things either. These are all things that have jeopardized the system. And I think people have gotten the message, yet still that gap is – there is a potential gap there. I think NOAA and the JPSS and GOES-R programs are for the moment on solid footing. I mean, I know there are all kinds of discussions and innuendos out there that could jeopardize that and put us at greater risk for the gap. But nevertheless, I think that the message hasn't been heard. But the gap still perhaps looms.
Let us go to our listeners, if I may. Jacob in Nashville, Tennessee. Jacob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me on the show and everything. Sure. So my comment is that it's pretty obvious that information about our atmosphere and about our ocean is critical to our way of life in America, and getting secondhand information from the Chinese government is just obviously it seems like a terrible idea, but, and I share the sentiment that, you know, this is crazy, you know, it's dumb, but I don't share the shock. It's been a long time coming that this problem, this problem has been approaching us for a long time. I firmly believe that it's because of, just right-wing, narrow-minded folks in the House of Representatives that have kept funding from being passed, and as far as like to NASA, NOAA.
Yeah, Jacob, you're breaking up, but I got the idea. Catherine Miles, are the political lines obvious here? Is this political neglect or deliberate attack on spending? How do you read the lines that led to this potential gap in front of us?
Well, I think it depends entirely on who you ask. And part of the problem is that this has always been a partnership. And so, you know, beginning in 1994, under a lot of pressure from Newt Gingrich and the Republicans for the Compact for America, Bill Clinton made the decision to combine the two satellite programs so that we took the Department of Defense and we took NOAA and we combined their two weather satellite programs.
Was
and
that a was problem? A, or
it was an unholy marriage from the start. And so they had you had two very different organizations that had very different priorities. And the amount of sort of infighting and dysfunction that happened is really sort of what caused this breakdown in satellite surplus. In 2010, President Obama severed the two organizations and made them their own. But now what we have is we have a partnership between NOAA and NASA where NOAA basically runs the program. NOAA sort of asks for what they want. And once the satellites are up in the air, NOAA is what is responsible for using the information, but NASA is in charge of procurement. And those two agencies live in different places, and they have very different funding streams. And so it's never been an obvious match. And I think what happens is because we have two different streams, we have two very different types of organizations, we've never been really clear how to keep both of them running.
Boy, I mean, we just barely want to hear that. It's like, get it right, get it done. We don't want to have to think about a big spaghetti mess behind it. It's too important. Bob in Ontonagon, Michigan. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, you don't need these satellites, and you don't need sophisticated computer models.
What are you going to do, Bob? You're just going to hold your finger in the wind?
You look out the window and read a bloody thermometer. It's been cooling off since 1998, if anybody bothered to notice. And you keep pumping up this climate change deal. The climate's always changing, And we should not have to pay more for electricity for a problem that isn't even there.
Bob, thanks. It sounds like you're gonna see the weather outside your window. I hope nothing too fierce hits that window. Bob Marshall, we don't need satellites.
Yeah, I'll let the comments speak for themselves. But more importantly, I think that most people aren't aware that our 1, 2, 3, 5, 7 day forecast are intimately related to the advances in satellite information. There was an error, perhaps when Tom was younger, where we just used weather balloons to initialize our weather forecast models. But unfortunately, that doesn't really capture how our atmosphere evolves. The satellite data that's being assimilated, that's a big fancy word that means basically we're injecting data into the models. That really improves our ability to represent what's going on with our atmosphere. So, you know, we can rely on rodents, groundhogs, almanacs, and all of that type of stuff in folklore. Yeah. But the reality is weather forecasting over the last several decades has improved. It's related to the fact that we have advanced satellites, advanced radar systems, very skilled National Weather Service colleagues, researchers. So, and I think we can't kind of blow off. I think what we heard there about in the climate change argument is what I like to call some of the zombie theories that are out there on climate change, these sort of theories that live on, even though scientists have kind of disproven them or sort of moved on from those. So we have to kind of move beyond the sort of politicization of weather and climate and realize that weather, climate, and the data that we collect are national assets. They're valuable to our daily lives now and going forward.
Hard to believe in the year 2017 we could have Groundhog Day as our one weather forecasting day of the year. Will yeah, in right. Boston. Will, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
I'm okay. What do you think?
So my question, and I admit that my expertise is limited to being an armchair meteorologist, but my question revolves around the fact that, you know, we talk about politicization, we talk about how hard it is to get people to agree on funding for satellites. Why don't we turn over the satellites to the private sector, to people like Elon Musk, SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, say, get them to be putting the satellites up in the air. Theoretically, we could have more at the ready at more time because they'd be competing with each other. Then use our funding from our government to fund the meteorologists and sort of the data specialists to analyze the data that we then get from the private sector.
Will, I got it. You're thinking outside the box, and let us think about it in just that way. I appreciate your call. Yep. Marshall Shepard, stand by. We'll come to you on that. Catherine Miles, Carrie Cahoy joins me now in the studio. She's assistant professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT, has worked on satellites for a long time now, in particular on small satellites, which might be manageable for the private sector to put up. Carrie, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the satellites we put up now are very big. They take a long time to put together. It's a big deal to get them up there. Could we do this with a lot of smaller satellites, and could we do it with satellites put up by the private sector?
Yeah. So this is a very interesting and timely question because putting up satellites themselves is a difficult thing. And we are currently in an era where we're starting to see little satellites, nanosatellites, shoebox-sized satellites, be able to go into space in large numbers. So there are launch providers who are putting these CubeSats, these shoebox-sized satellites.
Literally shoebox? I mean, aren't the ones up there now for weather, aren't they sort of the size of a house?
They are. They're the size of a large room, and they weigh about as much as a pickup truck. And I used to work on those.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, those satellites, commercial companies can put those up pretty quickly.
With the small ones or the big ones?
Both.
Okay.
Both commercial companies can put up big satellites in a couple of years. One of the tricks with these weather satellites that makes them so difficult is that the instruments on them require a lot of science background and planning and development. So a lot of that time and cost requires a lot of overhead there and a lot of the cost and expense.
But don't
comes
we
in.
Need all of that observational capacity up there? What are you saying? Break up the elements that are on these super satellites and put up lots? Each little satellite might have one thing it does instead of these big jack-of-all-trades Swiss Army knife satellites?
Exactly. So you could take the complexity of these instruments and try to take the couple that would do well on small satellites, like microwave radiometers, the kind that I work with, and distribute them into constellations. And then you could have these smaller, cheaper satellites that only cost a hundredth of what a major program would cost.
Mm-hmm.
And you could put up a large number of them much more frequently. You could try out new technologies, get a lot more global coverage. One of the great things about the polar satellites that we're so concerned about is getting constant updates every few hours mm-hmm. of weather data. And if you had a distributed constellation, if you had a constellation with lots of them around the Earth, you mm-hmm. could get much more frequent updates and populate your weather models with that kind of data on a more frequent basis.
Marshall Shepard, how about it? Maybe small satellites will save our bacon. Instead of putting up these giant behemoths, we put up a distributed constellation, a whole lot of little shoeboxes, and they bring home what we need to know.
Yeah, we just had on our show Weather Geeks on Weather Channel, we had Ann Miegel-Reese from Planet IQ, which is one of the companies that is thinking about doing this.
You know,
I've got to take a step back here and kind of give a bit of perspective. One of the things that it should be noted to the listeners is that the current model for weather satellite procurement is a private-public venture. Companies like Lockheed Martin, Harris, and others are very much in the loop with NASA and NOAA on the development of GOES-R and JPSS. So
but they just build, of course, but they just build it to spec. They're not.
Yeah, they do, but I still wanted to just make the point that there is a private venture. But more importantly, as we've just made the case here, the weather information is valuable. It's critical. I do believe that CubeSats, small sats certainly have a future. I'm just not sure that I'm ready to hand over the keys yet because many of these methods are untested. They've not even been launched. Some of these companies are startups. What if they go out of business? There are issues in terms of selling back to not only our government but other governments. So I think there are issues on the table. I think in concept, it sounds good and it sounds cheaper, faster, better, cheaper. I'll say that I worked for NASA for 12 years, and mm-hmm. I was in an era of the whole mantra of faster, better, cheaper at NASA, and that didn't turn out too well. I will also mention that two private ventures launched the GLORISAT satellite and the Orbiting Carbon Observatory satellite recently in a fairly and we lost those on launch. So I think we need to step back, evaluate the capacity. I think we are entering a new era of faster and quicker satellites, but I'm just not sure I'm ready to turn over the keys. The data is too valuable, and our weather forecasts depend on reliability and continuity.
Catherine Miles, Marshall Shepard suggests it's too risky to go private, maybe to go smaller. But the program we've got now, you've pointed out very plainly, is full of vulnerabilities. It's been in government hands, and we're facing a potential forecasting blackout.
Well, Marshall's point is an important one. It is in government hands, but as he mentioned, these are being created entirely by private companies. And that's part of what happened and has made the MPP, the satellite that's currently our primary polar site, part of why it's controversial is the fact that it didn't undergo NASA scrutiny as part of its building process. And that's part of what has the NASA engineers concerned. And when I posed the question of private and smaller satellites to folks both within the governmental arm and also the private sector of these satellite ventures, a lot of them said the same thing. And they always used a car metaphor. And they said, you know, okay, yeah, we can build Corollas and Corollas are cheaper, but if you need to get 10 people around town, you have to buy 3 Corollas. So why not buy 1 Escalade and get it done? And the other question they posed is in terms of rockets. And, you know, right now, rockets kind of come in 2 sizes. They come in really small and really big. And the really big ones cost a lot of money. The satellite that's going to launch the rocket that's going to launch the replacement satellite comes in with a price tag of about $100 million. So, you know, if you can get 1 satellite up and you can get it up on 1 rocket, you know, you also have some potential cost saving or some potential security there as well.
Boy, Carrie, there's a lot more we want to know, but I guess you just have to observe that maybe there's risk with private. Maybe there's a private element already that has been imperfect, but the government's been handling this and we're facing problems.
That's true. The government is actually doing a pretty good job of investigating the ability of small satellites to handle some of these replacement functions. They've been investing in programs to get these nanosatellites and sensors up in the next couple of years to help fill this gap that we're seeing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the looming risk of a United States that cannot forecast its own weather as we grapple with satellite problems in space. Satellites, we use them all the time to tell us what's coming in the weather. Here's just one report of thousands.
This is that bank of clouds, again, a visible satellite, and we, on purpose, we subtracted the color of the map so that the clouds really pop. This is exactly the way you would have seen it from space. Look at the just this roll of clouds, if you will, that was from Charleston right on up I-79.
We love looking, and they tell us what's coming, and it matters in our personal lives, in our businesses, all kinds of reasons. The country depends on it, but we've got aging satellites. We've got satellites that weren't intended to be up there for so long. By 2017, we could be looking at a gap. It could be a long gap, or could leave us depending on other countries' infrastructure for our own weather forecasting, on Chinese satellites that are put up by the Chinese military. Catherine Miles writes it all up for Popular Mechanics in a piece called The Weather Gap. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, author of the forthcoming Superstorm. Marshall Shepard has been in the thick of this at NASA and beyond, past president of the American Meteorological Association, co-hosts Weather Geeks on the Weather Channel on Sundays. He's director of atmospheric sciences at the University of Georgia. Carrie Cahoy is with me in the studio from MIT. She's worked on satellites for many years and is now looking at what they call nanosatellites, sort of shoebox size. Let's go to Josh calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Josh, you're on the air. What do you think?
Yes. What I have to say is, can you put a price on national security? I mean, what if another country was to hit their satellites and then we're blind? Why aren't there other satellites that are on standby ready to go up? Or if even if one satellite failed, why aren't there other satellites that are ready to go up? I mean, can you put a price on that? And if, I mean, that's priceless to me. And
Josh, we hear it loud and clear. It's an obvious question. Marshall Shepard, why don't we just have whatever we need lined up and ready to go?
Well, actually, we do in some cases. For example, last summer, one of the GOES satellites went down temporarily, and many may not realize that we do have a spare up there right now, and we're able to move that into a working orbit until they figured out the problem. Problem is that spare is rather old as well, and so it certainly is in jeopardy of playing out in any moment. And unfortunately, these, you know, I want to kind of emphasize to folks, I mean, I spent 12 years, and much of that time at NASA was developing a mission, the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, a constellation mission. Satellites are not like light bulbs. We can't just run down to the Home Depot and get another one when they blow out. And so there's quite a bit of cost involved in engineering them. I definitely hear the caller's concern. I actually agree with it somewhat that we need to have.
But his common sense understands that they're not like light bulbs.
It's
ready, have a backup. We're not some little country. We're the richest country on Earth, and we don't have another light bulb in the closet ready to go.
Well, we like I said, in the case of the geosynchronous, we do, but given budget issues, sort of tightening budgets, fiscal responsibility arguments that we hear, those spares cost money. And so if NOAA or NASA says, well, we don't have enough money to build two or a spare, they just have to go with what they go with. So, you know, we can't really have our cake and eat it too, although the common sense aspect is there. So I do agree with the caller, but it really does come down to budget.
Michael says, yes, we can get our information from other nations, but what happens when things don't go right in international relations? And Catherine, that happens. I mean, if we're depending on Chinese polar orbiting satellite data and we get into a rough spot with China, I don't know, then suddenly the data's cut off.
That's right. And Elon Musk actually raised that issue very recently because the rockets that we use to send these satellites into orbit use engines that are Russian. And so we rely on the Russians for not only our weather satellite rockets, but also our intelligence rockets. And that raises some national security issues, when we're looking at public relations with Russia, who is not always our best friend.
No, so lately it's been pretty rough right there. Pete in Franklin, Massachusetts. Pete, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Either way.
Actually, this is perhaps for Carrie. I wonder if you could invite her to expand a little bit more on what she thinks one of these constellations of nanosats would look like. I think, for example, of NASA's A-Train, which is their larger satellites, but Earth-observing satellites that follow each other sequentially. And as for the launch costs, these small satellites do not cost $100 million to launch because they go up as secondary payloads on rockets with larger satellites already as the primary payload.
Yeah, Carrie, fill out that picture. It's so interesting to think of many small ones, not these big giants.
Right. And so instead of talking about polar orbits and geostationary satellites, you could have a constellation of low Earth orbiting satellites, and you can imagine distributed 18, 20 of them all the way around the Earth, and they don't cost by any means $100 million to put up. In fact, we just launched one, and the cost more on the order of a couple $100,000 for a little one.
And that was a single launch, like one shoebox on side of one missile, or rocket?
And this one's deploying from the space station, and there are companies like the one we're working with called NanoRax who do this. And
Who sent it to the space station for you? How'd you get it up there?
We went up. The company is called Orbital on the Antares.
And they sent up their own rocket to the space station?
They send up cargo resupply. So we go up as cargo.
With groceries.
With groceries. And we get put out on the robotic arm and deployed. And maybe this isn't the way you would populate an entire constellation, or maybe you'd come up with a creative way to do it with one or two different launches.
When you say on the robot arm and deployed, will it remain attached to the space station? They're actually just dropping it off.
Think of a jack-in-the-box and that spring that pops the jack out, you actually pop your satellite out just like that with a spring.
That's pretty wild.
It is pretty fun.
If you were to, how many little shoeboxes would it take to replicate the data collection of one of these giant traditional weather satellites?
So we've done some studies on that and what we think would be sufficient. And right now we're looking at somewhere between 18 and 24.
Can you give any comfort to Marshall Shepard, who says, I'm not so sure about this. Companies can go out of business.
This is true.
We've had private satellite launches that have blown up. We've seen that happen. Who's minding the store? What if they sell it to somebody else?
Right. These are all very valid concerns, and I share them with Marshall for sure. I just am excited about the innovation and the potential capability that we could gain if we actually put some effort into this and did it, which we're trying to do. So commercial entities could, produce these small satellites in volume at, much cheaper prices than you could to build a much bigger satellite. And they could put them up regularly, and you could have government scientists developing the instruments and collecting the data and processing the data. There's nobody that says, in fact, it's very difficult to get data down from a satellite without going through some government licensing process. So there could be controls in that way.
Catherine, could a horde of little satellites come in and fill the gap that you're warning about starting in 2017, or do you see that as further down the road?
Well, it's really not what I see, but when I pose this to the folks at NOAA and NASA, basically what they said is that it's sort of a show-me-the-money situation where, as I asked one official at NOAA, and he said, look, there's a bunch of guys walking around Capitol Hill with PowerPoint slides, but I haven't seen any technology. And so I think it's really a question of will we get there and how long will it take us to get there?
I mean, I've got an astronautics professor sitting with me right here in the studio, and she's got one already up on the space station. That's kind of show-me-the-money, isn't it?
I guess so. I mean, we'll put her in touch with the NOAA folks, and maybe they can work it out.
Yeah, could I just
Marshall,
quickly
yes,
say, yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to emphasize, I'm all for this sort of innovative technology. I think we are entering an era where the big giant program may be kind of in its last phases. But I'm on record as saying I am not willing to turn over the keys just yet. The weather forecast data is too important. I think the concepts will be there in the future. It's just not time, and I do not want to jeopardize current GOES-R and JPSS program. Yeah, they've had their problems, but for the next 5-10 years, they're probably going to be what's going to continue to provide weather satellite data for our models and for the safety of our U.S. citizens.
Kind of incredible that we're even having this conversation about the vulnerability of weather forecasting data in an era where it is so important to have. But there we are, and maybe with some technological change, maybe some privatization on the horizon that may help us out as well. Marshall Shepard, former president of the American Meteorological Society, director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia, thank you very much for being with us today, Marshall.
Thank you.
Carrie Cahoy, assistant professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT. Carrie, wonderful to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
And Catherine Miles. Her new book is Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Look for it. She's written in Popular Mechanics. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, entrepreneur Elon Musk has big plans for a spaceport in Texas. This is On Point. Elon Musk of PayPal fame and Tesla Motors fame is also CEO of the private space transport company SpaceX. He recently announced plans to build a brand spanking new commercial space launch facility in Brownsville, Texas.
To tell us more, Dave Brody joins us from New York. He's executive producer at the website space.com. Dave Brody, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Good. What's on the drawing board here?
Well, it's more than actually on the drawing board. SpaceX has been purchasing real estate quietly at first, starting several years ago, and now publicly because they have decided that that's where they would like to locate their spaceport. And you can think of Cape Canaveral, Florida in the late 50s, now transported to Brownsville, Texas, right down there on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's about as far south as you can get in the continental United States, and that's good because the further south you go, the more of a boost Mother Earth gives you in going to orbit, right?
Texas, so, Houston in particular, involved in space exploration for a long, long time. We've all heard those old tapes of, you know, Houston, we hear you from the moon and all the rest. Had there ever been space launches from Texas?
Yes, there have been. There was an attempt to privatize a rocket in the 1980s that was before its time and failed commercially, which is why you don't know much about it. But yes, there have been launch attempts out of Texas. And in fact, SpaceX themselves tests their rockets in McGregor, Texas. So they have engine test stands, and every Merlin engine that goes on their Falcon booster is tested in Texas before it's launched out of California or Florida now, and will be tested in Texas before it's launched out of Texas.
So with this new facility, what scale of spaceport is Elon Musk planning?
Well, because there aren't many spaceports around, there isn't much to compare it to. Cape Kennedy, in its heyday, took advantage of being co-located with the Air Force launch pads all down the coast. So that's one of the elements that allowed the Kennedy Space Center to grow to the scale that it did. So this won't be quite that large, but you know, all you need is one functioning pad if you can turn a rocket around frequently and launch very often. And SpaceX is talking about a flight rate of 12 per year, so an average of once a month. And importantly, they expect to launch their Falcon 9 Heavy, a rocket that has never yet flown, but it's an uprated version of their current Falcon 9, which has been establishing a track record of good success. And that rocket will be the most powerful launcher that has ever launched, except for the Saturn V rockets that took Apollo to the moon, right there out of a pad in Texas.
Yeah, 12 launches a year. How does that compare with traffic out of Cape Canaveral these days?
Well, actually, the United Launch Alliance that launches payloads for the military is capable of doing exactly that flight rate. So it's not a question of being able to go up more often, although that will happen in time. It's more a question of establishing that track record of safety so that there is trust that's built up in Elon Musk's venture. And that is starting to happen in the commercial community.
We're hearing something like an $85 million facility here. We've seen the Texas governor, Rick Perry, celebrating this. Is Texas subsidizing this, or is there a government finger in here?
Oh, there sure is. And, you know, like whenever industry wants to locate to your town, you are, as the mayor and the local development commission, goes out and tries to give them incentives. And there have been a number of incentives from the state of Texas. $2.3 million from the Texas Enterprise Fund, which is a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the $565 million that they have to spend, and they've already spent on other projects. But $13 million from the Spaceport Trust Fund directly to the Cameron County Spaceport Development Corporation. And in return for that, they expect this $85 million capital expenditure investment into the local economy, which you mentioned, which translates, the governor's office says, 300 local jobs. Cameron County folks are even more optimistic. They're thinking more like $100 million and 500 or 600 local jobs.
Dave, does SpaceX have enough business lined up to support that volume of launches, 12 a year?
The problem is the opposite way around. They have too much business and they're desperate to launch. So they will continue to launch out of Cape Canaveral. They'll continue to launch out of California, and they will build this new facility in Cameron County, Texas. And that's not the end. I mean, you can think of this as the very early days of the airline industry. We might see SpaceX launching out of a number of places around the country and internationally. There's no reason why not. And really what this is all about is to try and get airplane-like operations into space launch and space travel. That's not to say that the vehicle has to have wings and look like an airplane, but it has to operate like one. It has to be turned around quickly by a small crew for not a lot of money.
What portion of their volume of stuff going up are commercial payloads versus what they're putting up for the U.S. government?
In the case of SpaceX, it's going to vary quite a bit. They do have commercial contracts that far outweigh the number of contracts they have with NASA. But currently, they have a $1.6 billion contract to do commercial resupply services. That's delivering to the space station underwear and socks and groceries you mentioned in the last segment machinery and science. And also to pick up their trash and take it back. So, that's a robust flight, right? But they definitely have more commercial traffic than they have government traffic.
If it goes on schedule, when might we see the first launch out of Brownsville?
I don't think anybody wants to put their nickel down and say quite yet, because it is a commercial company. Except in the case when they're launching government satellites, they don't have to tell us. And that's a new paradigm in the launch business. It used to be that, NASA did business because it was paid for by taxpayer dollars. Everything was open to all of us. SpaceX doesn't have to do that, so they're not going to say exactly when they'll launch. They'll launch when they're ready and when it's safe.
But taxpayers are paying them $1 billion-plus to take groceries to the space station. Kind of like to know, but we'll pay attention and see as things unfold. Dave Brody at space.com, executive producer there in New York. Thanks so much for joining us, Dave. Great to have you.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Abigail Collins and Gretel Kaufman, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.